am Larry Nicks, senior associate here at CSIS, and I am going to be your moderator this afternoon for what I think is going to be a very interesting seminar, the purpose of which is to present to you a very important report two very prominent scholars, Bonnie Glaser and Scott Snyder, have done, entitled Preparing for Instability in North Korea, U.S., South Korea, China Coordination. They're going to tell you about this paper, give you an idea of the main content of this paper. The project has been a long one, going back several years, and it has involved very extensive research that both Bonnie and Scott have carried out over that period of time. Now, the biographical information is very extensive, and I urge you to please read it because our panelists today have very, very strong credentials. Bonnie is the senior fellow with the CSIS Freeman Chair in China Studies here at CSIS, and she's also a senior associate with CSIS Pacific Forum. Bonnie has spoken and written extensively, as I think all of you know, and to me, Bonnie is the czar, or perhaps I should say czarina, of research on issues in U.S.-China relations. And I think that perhaps is the best way to sum up this very extensive career that is outlined in her biographical statement. Now, Scott, I think, is known to just about anybody who is interested in Korea and U.S.-Korea relations. I have worked with him over many years, and I know a number of you in the audience have also been involved in projects and research that Scott has carried out. He currently is the director of the Center for U.S.-Korea Policy and a senior associate of the Washington Programs in the International Relations Program of the Asia Foundation. He is also a senior associate at the Pacific Forum CSIS. I love how they're both connected with Hawaii, by the way. And is an adjunct senior fellow for Korean Studies at the Consul and Foreign Relations. And he is active in research projects in all of these endeavors, all of these organizations at the present time. Now, as our commentator today, we have Richard Lawless, who has a very extensive biography in terms of his work over the years in both government and the private sector. He currently is the president and chief executive officer of the New Magellan Venture Partners, and he is a prime consultant in the area of commercial nuclear energy. He has served many years in the U.S. government, and he principally was the Deputy Secretary of Defense for East Asian Affairs during the Bush administration. And the notable thing that I remember about his career during that period is that he was at the center of the very, very important alliance negotiations with South Korea about changing the U.S. force structure in South Korea, negotiations that went on from 2003 to 2008 and produced some very, very important agreements between the U.S. and the ROK during that period. He also has done similar things in key negotiations with Japan during those years, and some of those issues, of course, we have seen discussed very recently in news articles about the U.S.-Japan relationship. Now, Bonnie and Scott are going to talk each, I believe, for about 20 minutes, and then we will hear Mr. Lawless's commentary on the paper. At that point, we will open it up for question and answers. Which one of you will go first? Scott will go first, so let's begin with his presentation.
Okay. Well, thank you, Larry, for that generous introduction. We all know that CSIS and Bonnie have very good timing because there's a lot of focus on the North Korea-China relationship even today, even though we can't get anybody to actually officially admit that anything is going on. I realized on my way over here that instead of working on this report, I should have been developing my Where in the World is Kim Jong-il app for an iPhone. We're here to explore a topic that Bonnie and I have been working on together for some years, examining perceptions regarding situation in North Korea, stability in North Korea, and to the question of whether or not it's possible for the United States and China and South Korea to have an effective dialogue that can help to overcome some of the differences that exist, especially related to some specific related to differing interests that the U.S. and China and South Korea have that really hamper effective policy coordination toward the North. We all know that over the course of the past year, we've had Kim Jong-il's health scare. We've had just back in November currency revaluation. The economy seems very unstable. We've seen pictures of Kim Jong-il just over the course of the past few days, and it really does make people think, well, what is next, and are we really prepared for what is next? And so I think it's arguable that we really need to have this discussion about how to deal with the possibility of instability in North Korea, issues related to possible refugee flow, issues related to the safety of North Korea's nuclear weapons materials. All these sorts of issues really are not unthinkable. They are issues that are imaginable, and that there are issues that, in particular, China and South Korea and the United States should be able to have some discussion on. One reason why it's important, I think, maybe the main reason why it's important to have this kind of discussion is not necessarily because we are expecting instability to occur tomorrow, but rather because these are the core issues on which it's clear that there are differing interests. Issues related to the end state of the Korean Peninsula end up being the core issues where there are apparent divergences among the three. So if we can begin to have a conversation that tries to address some of those issues, it can also help us to map out a basis for joint action and for a stronger cooperative security approach to dealing with the region. So we think that there's a basis for cooperation and that there are some areas of common interest that can be the basis for this conversation that can help promote stability. Also, this kind of dialogue can serve as the basis for mitigating the risks of accidental conflict or misunderstanding based on mutual suspicions, while coordination can help to enhance prospects for a peaceful transition to a more stable peninsula. So what we've done in the paper is really to try to analyze, in particular, Chinese and South Korean interests and approaches toward North Korea first, in order to understand where they conflict with each other. And then we analyze impediments on the Chinese and South Korean side, respectively, to cooperation. We analyze a little bit about what we know about respective plans to deal with instability in North Korea, and then we make some recommendations. And so what I want to do is take care of the first part of that, to really go through Chinese interests and approaches to North Korea, and also South Korean interests and approaches to North Korea, and kind of give a flavor of some of the debate which we've been analyzing, you know, both through media analysis and through extensive private conversations with specialists on these issues in Seoul and Beijing. So as we look at China's primary interests and approaches to North Korea, we've identified four main interests: peace, stability, averting a hostile presence on the Korean Peninsula, and promotion of denuclearization. I just want to go through each of those. China's interest in peace arguably stems from the experience of the Korean War and their desire not to get into that kind of conflict again. We know that China and North Korea have a treaty obligation, which is also an aspect of a desire to, I think, maintain some kind of avert war on the peninsula. We know that as part of that discussion related to the China DPRK treaty, that China is has stated that it's not operative in the context of North Korean aggression against the South. With regard to stability, I think that Chinese concerns are twofold, both internal and external concerns related to stability in North Korea. And maybe the most recent, the concerns that you can see related to instability, you know, one is related to refugee overflow. Clearly, there's a concern about spillover into northeastern China. Most recently, China has had other experience in dealing with refugees on the border with Myanmar, and that actually has been cited as an example that has given China some kind of experience in dealing with that type of issue. I actually think that the biggest example of China's concern about stability in North Korea comes from the number of times that Chinese analysts have told us that we don't need to worry about it. They're doing all the worrying for us. And so I think that does reveal a concern in that area. A third interest is the avoidance of a hostile presence on the Korean Peninsula. And here, there's some interesting literature, for instance, about concerns that if China overemphasizes the nuclear issue, that could turn North Korea into a threat to China. So there's a view that maintenance of the China-North Korea relationship, you know, is one basis upon which to try to ensure that North Korea doesn't become hostile to China, but at the same time, there's a concern about that possibility. And then most recently, President Hu Jintao stated that it's in the fundamental interest of the Chinese and North Korean peoples to have a good China-DPRK relationship, and that that benefits peace, stability, and prosperity in the region and the world. And then our fourth interest, China's fourth interest as it relates to North Korea, is denuclearization. And we understand that, you know, certainly China was concerned about the impact of North Korea's two nuclear tests. We'll talk about that in greater detail a little bit later. But, you know, their concerns about North Korea's nuclear program also are related to risks related to accident, the possibility that an accident, a nuclear accident, could have a spillover effect onto China. The North Korean nuclear program also has had an impact, arguably, on the regional security balance. And we know that that's a Chinese vital interest, is the maintenance of a regional security environment that is benign from their perspective, that that there aren't activities that increase tensions in the regional security environment. And then China does have an interest in seeing the NPT upheld. And so China has come to view that a nuclear, unstable, and unpredictable North Korea could actually be a kind of danger, I think. Now, in terms of debates or approaches to North Korea, there are several issues that we highlight in the paper. One is a debate that has continued over the question of whether North Korea is a strategic asset or a strategic liability. To a certain extent, this is also reflected in a report that ICG did last year, where they had two camps. I liked one of the quotes from the ICG report that reflects the traditionalist view that China's mindset has changed, but the length of their border has not. there's that view. But then there's also a reflection, I think, among some Chinese analysts that North Korea has begun to take actions that are undermining security, that they're risking Chinese interests, and that, in the words of one group of analysts from Kicker, that China cannot, quote-unquote, support in an unprincipled way the DPRK's moves in stubbornly following its own course and heightening regional tensions. We can also look at the way that the debate has proceeded among Chinese analysts from the 2006 nuclear test through the 2009 nuclear test. And although the Chinese government position seems to have strengthened in terms of its support for and commitment to the China-DPRK relationship, if we look at views of Chinese analysts, it seems that there is a much more active and open debate and a larger group of analysts that are now more critical about aspects of the China-DPRK relationship. And I think that one particular aspect of it that was interesting was following the 2009 test last summer, a poll that showed that Chinese analysts were split on whether or not to consider the use of sanctions. And traditionally, Chinese analysts had not been supporting the use of sanctions as it relates to North Korea. Another indicator that is not in the report, but that I just saw about 3 weeks ago, was part of the BBC Global poll regarding countries' attitudes toward each other. And they also did a polling in China. And one of the findings was that the Chinese public attitude, the positive attitudes toward North Korea, had dropped precipitously over the course of the past year from the low 40s to about the mid-20s. These are, I think, issues that are part of the debate. Obviously, the Chinese government has advocated consistently use of diplomatic means to approach the North Korea issue. The Chinese foreign ministry spokesman, I think, likes to use the phrase remain cool-headed when any of these issues come up. In the midterm, the Chinese approach is really still to promote or try to find a way to promote economic reforms in North Korea. And the long-term view is really the idea that maybe there could be a Korean unification, Commonwealth-type arrangement for unification. Essentially, Beijing's preconditions for unification are that it not come at the expense of peace and stability on China's periphery, that it must be self-determined by the people of both Koreas, and that it cannot be forced by outside actors. Then as we look at South Korea's interests and approaches to the issue of North Korean instability or to the issue of North Korea, we identified five primary interests that South Korea has shown over the course of the past decades. And we all know that that South Korea's policy has fluctuated quite a bit from administration to administration. We've seen many different types of approaches and trying to deal with North Korea. But I think that it's possible to identify some consistencies despite these different approaches. And so the five interests that we identified for South Korea are, one, peaceful coexistence, two, dominance of the South Korean system during integration and eventual Korean reunification, three, extension of South Korea's influence in North Korea, four, denuclearization, and five, continuation of the security relationship with the United States. And so if I just go through those before I turn it over to Bonnie to detail suspicions and recommendations. The first objective of peaceful coexistence really is embodied in the basic agreement, the inter-Korean declaration on non-aggression exchanges and reconciliation from 1991. So it's been a longstanding, I think, objective that was embodied in that agreement. Of course, that agreement was not fulfilled, so it was aspirational. But even to today, Im Young-bak, as part of his policy, has said that we need to, quote-unquote, devise fundamental strategies for inter-Korean coexistence and prosperity. With regard to the dominance of the South Korean system during integration and eventual Korean unification, it's actually reflected in the Korean Constitution. Constitution calls for a peaceful Korean reunification based on principles of freedom and democracy. But it's also reflected even in the joint vision statement from June of last year that was issued by President Obama and President Lee, where it says that the two countries should, that the goal is to establish a durable peace on the Korean Peninsula leading to peaceful reunification on principles of a free democracy and market economy. The third objective is denuclearization, and we see that back in 1992, South and North tried to negotiate a joint denuclearization agreement, which obviously has not been implemented either. But, you know, denuclearization, I think, has been objective. I think it was actually a it was an issue that progressive administrations also worked on. In my view, it was actually a precondition for the Sunshine Policy to really begin back in 1998-1999. And then we see that the Lee administration is once again following a denuclearization-first policy, essentially, making that the centerpiece or the precondition for moving forward on many other issues in the inter-Korean relationship. And then the fourth objective or interest is desire on the part of South Korea to maintain influence or expand its influence in North Korea. And arguably, we can even see that effort as part of South Korea's most recent diplomacy, for instance, just last week with China. As it has pressed in terms of essentially pursuing an international approach to the Chun'an incident and the response. But this has been a kind of enduring, I think, desire. There's always a concern in the South Korean media about whether or not South Korean governments are being marginalized. We see this from time to time. In the context of discussions about the six-party talks, in the discussion about great power influence on the peninsula. And then the last interest on the part of South Korea is really to maintain an alliance with the United States as part of this process. I think that that has been a hallmark of both conservative and progressive administrations. Kim Dae-jung was quite explicit in stating that he thought there was a role for the alliance beyond Korean unification. And I think that even Noh Moo-hyun's national security strategy reflected the objectives of a cooperative, self-reliant defense and a strong alliance. And so I think that that also is an interest that has existed on both sides of the South Korean political spectrum. I'm going to stop there, and we're going to move on to suspicions and to Bonnie.
Thank you very much, Scott, and thank you, Larry, for the kind introduction. In 2006, Scott and I made our first visit with some other American colleagues to China to talk with Chinese experts on North Korea, and we've been taking delegations every year since then. And I have really been struck, I think both of us have, with the deep suspicions that are held by Chinese experts and even officials, both toward South Korea and U.S. Intentions. For the United States, it's our global intentions. For South Korea, it's more pertaining to intentions on the peninsula. But it is really that concern that we have about these suspicions that we have heard expressed over the last few years that I think motivated us to write this report, because in the absence of addressing some of these suspicions, it really makes it very, very difficult for the United States, South Korea, and China to cooperate in the event that there is instability in North Korea. Now, admittedly, addressing suspicions may not be sufficient. Certainly progress in other areas may be required. For example, before China is likely to agree to engage in dialogue and cooperation with the U.S. and the ROK on what they consider to be such a sensitive topic, I think the Chinese probably will have to be convinced that instability in North Korea is both likely and dangerous, and that the risks of inaction, that is, not coordinating with the U.S. and ROK, are greater than the risks of such coordination. Today, this judgment, in my view, does not exist, and Beijing does not view trilateral coordination as urgent, and it continues to see the risks of such cooperation as greater than the benefits. So assuaging suspicions may not in and of itself lead to cooperation, but it is nevertheless a good place to start. And so I will begin by describing some of the suspicions that the Chinese have toward the U.S. and South Korea, and then some of the suspicions that the South Koreans have toward China. In one conversation that we had when we were in China last year, one of the participants in our group was discussing in the event that there was instability in North Korea and if there was a shortage of food that countries would want to help provide humanitarian assistance, and we would want to provide information to the North Korean people as to where food was being brought and how they could get access to it, so that people would not necessarily start migrating in very large numbers towards the borders but would know where to go to get food. And one of the Chinese participants who was listening immediately thought that the United States was talking about using the radio stations in some way that might seek to further undermine stability and raise the example of the events in Tiananmen Square in 1989 and how the United States had been using the Voice of America to convey some information to the Chinese people. And that, to me, was really a stark example of how we can actually have common interests where we would both want to help the people in North Korea and bring food in, and yet there's these suspicions that really hamper us from working together. So that's just one example. I will lay out more systematically what we write in the report about these suspicions. First, the Chinese worry that South Korea would seize upon signs of instability in the north to send forces northward, north of the 38th parallel, to achieve reunification. The Chinese insist strongly that, in their view, South Korea has no legal basis to intervene in the north, that North Korea is a sovereign country. They reject the South Korean constitutional basis for intervention, and some Chinese even argue that their treaty with North Korea provides a better legal basis, should they be asked to provide assistance to the North, than South Korea has, although I should caveat that by saying that the Chinese say that they would prefer to not get involved. The Chinese themselves would say they're not looking for an excuse to send forces into North Korea in any case, but they would demand that any dispatch of forces by any country, including South Korea, should be done under a new UN authority. We have even heard some military researchers warn that if South Korea were to send forces across the DMZ, that China would not stand by or stand idly by, as they say, and do nothing. Secondly, the Chinese are suspicious of the role of the U.S.-ROC alliance in peacetime, in a crisis, and in a future unified Korea. They talk about the strategic flexibility that is being introduced in the U.S.-ROC alliance and ask the question of what roles the alliance might have off the peninsula. And indeed, the Chinese, many of them, are suspicious that U.S. forces stationed on the peninsula could be dispatched to the Taiwan Strait in a crisis. They ask questions about the scope of cooperation between the United States and South Korea under various concepts and operational plans, and claim that the U.S. and the ROK are insufficiently transparent. Third, the Chinese are concerned about the possibility that South Korea could inherit North Korea's nuclear weapons. And I would cite as one recent example that in the key resolve exercises in South Korea this year, the U.S. and ROK forces exercised capabilities to jointly locate and secure DPRK-WMD, and Chinese experts cite this as exacerbating their concerns. Fourth, some Chinese suspect that U.S. forces could be deployed in North Korea for an extended period of time under what they would say is various pretexts and might even be stationed close to China's border. So the United States might insert special forces to secure WMD and then would see reasons to extend their presence and deployment there. And fifth, many Chinese suspect that the U.S. seeks to use the Korean Peninsula more broadly in a strategic encirclement or containment policy, if you will, of China. And this is really part of course, a larger concern that the Chinese have, that the U.S. seeks to thwart China's reemergence as a great power and prevent China's rise as a peer competitor to U.S. power, both regionally and globally. A related Chinese concern is that the U.S. seeks to weaken China's relationship with South Korea and to reduce China's influence on the Korean Peninsula. Turning to South Korean suspicions, I would start by saying that in the event of instability, I think there are suspicions about what the Chinese would do, whether just as the Chinese think that the South Koreans might seize the opportunity to unify the peninsula, I think there are many in South Korea who suspect that China would seize this opportunity to enter into North Korea and potentially might seek to prop up a regime or respond to a faction in North Korea that might ask for China's assistance with the goal of ensuring that North Korea remains a separate sovereign state, a buffer along Chinese border, and that it would obstruct reunification. South Koreans, I think, generally believe that China prefers the two Korea status quo and therefore opposes reunification. Most are convinced that Beijing can most effectively protect its interests and advance its influence by having good relations with the two Koreas while at the same time maintaining peace and stability on the peninsula. Considering the fact that unification is, of course, a national goal for Seoul, this is a major obstacle to greater trust in the Sino-South Korean relationship. And finally, many South Koreans see their country as increasingly in economic competition with China and North Korea. China is seen as stepping up investment in North Korea to position itself to preserve good relations with and influence in the North in this period of power transition. And South Koreans worry that Beijing's expanded economic role in the North might limit the South's influence and make future unification difficult. Now I want to turn to briefly discuss the implications for the United States and some of our policy recommendations. The United States, of course, has vital interests at stake on the Korean Peninsula. First, of course, because of our very close security alliance with the ROK, the concerns that we have about nuclear proliferation, and the broader role that the United States plays in maintaining stability in Northeast Asia. So, therefore, even though instability in North Korea might not have a direct impact on the United States, it would nevertheless have important reasons to work with South Korea and China to promote the trilateral coordination and cooperation that we are advocating. And we propose a set of policy recommendations, really, for all three countries in our report that are aimed at easing mistrust and enhancing prospects for dialogue and cooperation on security issues, including coping with instability in North Korea. We believe, as I said earlier, that we really need to begin with taking steps to assuage suspicions, and that by doing so, the three nations will be better able to effectively coordinate and cooperate, not only on matters pertaining to response to instability in North Korea, but this would also help promote cooperation to address the goal of denuclearization, as well as on broader issues relating to long-term Northeast Asian stability and prosperity. So let me just cover a few recommendations. First, it is important that all three countries affirm their shared interest in comprehensive and verifiable denuclearization of the peninsula. And an understanding must be reached among the United States and South Korea and China that stability and denuclearization constitutes a basis for trilateral cooperation. The U.S. and the ROK should make clear that they do not seek to induce instability, that they have no interest in promoting regime change in North Korea, and they should remain committed to pursuing cooperation with authorities in the DPRK through negotiations as long as a government remains in place in North Korea that exercises national control. All three countries should discuss the circumstances under which foreign military intervention would be necessary and agree that international coordination is desirable prior to the deployment of any forces into North Korea. At a minimum, each party should pledge to notify the other two of its actions and its objectives prior to dispatching forces into North Korea. And for the U.S. and China, there should be a declaration that neither has an interest in establishing a long-term military presence north of the 38th parallel. To the extent possible, the U.S. and South Korea should increase the transparency of their joint planning to mitigate Chinese suspicions. Now, there are obviously limits to what can be shared, but surely taking at least a conceptual approach, there can be discussions between the U.S. and the ROK and China to talk about the joint planning that the two sides are engaged in to prepare for responding to instability in North Korea. And this would include the circumstances under which we, our two countries, the U.S. and South Korea, perceive a need to deploy forces north of the 38th parallel. There should also be a discussion of the issue of the authority under which such missions would be conducted. And there should be clarification about what role South Korean forces would play in locating and securing WMD facilities. Now, in return, clearly China should be more forthcoming about its plans in a number of areas. First, its plans to cope with the possibility of large numbers of refugees, which would be of grave concern to the international community. Is China willing to work with other countries to help provide assistance, and how it would do that? Of course, advanced coordination would make such an operation to launch a humanitarian assistance, essentially operation, far more effective than if there is no dialogue in advance. The Chinese should also make clear the circumstances under which it would deem it necessary to insert its own forces into North Korea and make it clear whether or not China would be willing to work with the United States and the ROK, not only for humanitarian relief purposes, but also for the missions of locating and destroying and securing weapons of mass destruction. As part of this greater transparency by the U.S. and South Korea, there should also be discussions about the missions of the alliance in the future, beyond the peninsula and potentially in a reunified Korea. And some assurances could be offered in that regard. To enhance prospects for successful trilateral coordination, engagement does need to be structured appropriately. And there needs to be an understanding on the need for dialogue and cooperation on responses to instability that might occur in North Korea at the highest levels of government. I believe it would be very important to have all three presidents agree that there is a need to have such a discussion, a dialogue, and begin the process of information sharing and enhanced coordination. Then channels could be established to share more information, and we advocate that task forces should be created in all three countries that include both military planners and civilian officials responsible for humanitarian relief and reconstruction operations. We advocate that trilateral coordination among these three task forces would be optimal, but an alternative could be to begin with bilateral coordination mechanisms between China and the ROK and the U.S.-China as an interim step. Although our report focuses on U.S.-South Korea-China trilateral coordination, there is a very important need to include Japan, a key U.S. ally in the region, and also to involve Russia. Both countries have important interests at stake. Japan, again, as a key U.S. ally, should be kept informed of all discussions, and consideration should be given to establishment of a broader mechanism that brings in Russia and China into the discussions and the process at some point. The U.S. should also make greater efforts, I think, to assuage Chinese concerns about U.S. strategic encirclement and containment of China. This may be something that is unachievable. It is, I think, that the United States has told China in many ways that it wants to seek a strong, a prosperous, a secure, and successful China. Often these fall on deaf ears. But I do think that we could do more in concrete terms to try and address some of the concerns that China has that the United States actually seeks to undermine China's security. And I would mention in this regard that it would be desirable from my point of view to have discussions with Beijing about our missile defense capabilities and plans in the same way that we have offered to Moscow. The Obama administration was recently offered to have these kinds of discussions with Russia. And if we would like to have discussions with China in the future about their nuclear policy and strategic doctrine and include them in the process of strategic arms control, as is stated in our nuclear posture review, then I think it is important for us to begin those kinds of efforts with China as well as with Russia. And finally, I would say that regardless of the outcome or progress of a dialogue that is focused on North Korean instability, the three nations should agree to coordinate to ensure timely and effective emergency humanitarian relief operations. Effective advance coordination will enable greater efficiency in the execution of emergency response measures that will undoubtedly be needed to save lives. Thank you very much.
Let us now turn to Mr. Lawless for his commentary on Bonnie and Scott's paper and their remarks today. Mr. Lawless.
Thank you. I think it's appropriate to begin my remarks by complimenting Bonnie and Scott and the folks that work with them over these many months, actually over these many years, in pulling this report together. I regard it, as many of us do, as extremely ambitious, absolutely necessary. Ambitious both in terms of the scope of what it's attempting to address, the historical perspective, I think, that it's attempting to capture, and probably most ambitious in terms of some of the policy suggestions or proposals that have just been made. Maybe ambitious to the point of not being possible, but certainly worth trying. Bonnie, the Tsarina, and certainly Scott have asked me to make comments on the paper that are both provocative and prescriptive. I will do so. There's really so much here to get one's arms around that what I'd like to do is just talk about a few elements of the report that I find of particular interest, and then identify one particular development that I think continues to evolve that may change some of the dynamic, not altering the conclusions of the report, but may change the tempo and the dynamic that's included in the report, if I could, in closing, and in that way perhaps encourage some discussion. First of all, I probably should comment that, as many of you know, some of us are no great fans of what's called the Track 2 process. We believe the Track 2 process at times has its own problems in and of itself, particularly when the Track 2 process is attempting to address itself to problems or policy issues that should best be handled, given willing governments and willing policy structures, to be handled in a direct way. That, in this particular case, is not the case. We have here a situation that not only cries out for a Track 2 process, the one that has been described, but probably is the single most vexing issue that I encountered in at least my 5 years in the policy shop at Asia Pacific in OSD policy. And indeed, even beyond my own shop within the entire policymaking community, beyond that, the elements of the U.S. government that support that community, be it the analytical process or the intelligence collection and analytical process. This has been a very, very tough issue for all of us for many years, and here I'm talking about how we manage or adapt ourselves to a dialogue with the other major players, namely China and the Republic of Korea, to the threat of instability in North Korea. Again, I use the word vexing because it was a continuing problem that we struggled to get our hands around. So, therefore, I not only welcome the Track 2 approach that's being taken here, but basically I'm saying it's probably the only way that we've got to go at the present time, given the deep-seated issues, suspicions, whatever they may be, that constrain, block, or otherwise make impossible a dialogue directly between the United States and China on this issue. It shouldn't be this way. It is, and that's where we are. I think that, again, in mentioning that the Track 2 approach is the only way that we have to go on this at the present time, I think that we have to accept at this point that as a real possibility that we need to proceed to collectively plan for event mitigation, some level of managed intervention as necessary, and longer-term stability as the evolved entity that was North Korea is either migrated into the Republic of Korea or somehow sustained outside the Republic of Korea during some transitional period. This may be a lengthy period, but whatever this entity is that we all agree that has to be sustained or can be sustained has to have some level of independence that's agreeable to the three parties and, indeed, has to have an end game that all of us agree meets the mutual or at least has some compromise involved that meets the ambitions of all the main parties involved, but particularly the Republic of Korea and China. I think that we will, of course, need the support of other regional players as well as the support of the international community. None of this will be easy, but I think it is beyond stupid. It is incredibly irresponsible that we are not today planning in a detailed way for the mitigation of such a crisis on the Korean Peninsula. I believe that the regime in North Korea It is not so much an issue for me that it is able to manage its own internal processes, but it is incapable of self-restraint. And I'll get into that in a minute, but my concern is being incapable of self-restraint and being a nuclear weapon state brings with it certain conditions and certain threats that involve all the countries in the region to a much greater degree. The report authors, in particular in the section on North Korea futures and the Sino-ROK security dilemmas, do bemoan the fact that, slightly if I may, that there has been too much focus perhaps on the denuclearization issue, somewhat to the distraction of the issue of instability and coping with instability. And I think that that's a reasonable criticism, if you will, or a reasonable observation. But I think the immediate consequences of instability are profound, and there is indeed scope for a lot of disagreement among the three principal players, particularly between China and the Republic of Korea. I believe that as things now stand, as we sit here today, I would judge that the opportunity for misunderstanding, miscues, misjudgment, miscalculation, resulting in conflict, both political and military, is significant, and it's getting worse with time. This is a problem, I believe, if ignored, will absolutely not resolve itself. Any suggestions, any whistling past the graveyard that things will eventually get better and somehow less conflict-oriented are not borne out by our experiences. I think the situation will only become more threatening, and I believe that part and parcel of the problem, and again I'll come back to this, is the North Korean appreciation of itself and where it's going in this overall mix is really a forcing function for this entire problem. And again, I think that this study, as it addresses the relationships among the United States, China, and North Korea, excuse me, and the Republic of Korea, places North Korea in sort of an odd man out category because we simply are assuming for the purposes of this study that there will be a situation of instability and that in this destabilized situation, the three of us will have to take some concerted action. I actually think, again, that North Korea may be the forcing function, the catalyst that forces all of us to deal with this much sooner and much more directly. Again, the report notes that the Republic of Korea and the United States remain constrained in their ability to prepare for the worst, and in so constrained, prefer the status quo to as a permanent two-state peninsula solution. My question would be, and it's not necessarily to the report writers, but it's to be provocative, how can the United States promote mutual trust among China, the Republic of Korea, and the United States to the degree that we would be able to enable discussions to begin again on the consequences of instability in the North Korea? I know that this paper is created by a U.S.-led team. I know that it and understand that it had input from others, but there is a good deal in this paper that does a lot of self-tasking to the United States. It puts a lot on our back, perhaps reasonably so, without calling some of the things that are the way they are. The very nation, I believe, that is arguably the most challenged by this entire situation may not be the Republic of Korea, but may be China. And I think China may potentially be the nation with the most to lose. And the party among the three that may be most responsible for the dilemma, as it's been delivered today, as far as I am concerned, is China. In this case, it takes three to dance to solve this problem. And however the report, this report, weaves the narrative and constructs the dynamic, the fact is, at least to date, from my personal perception, we have two people dancing and one wallflower, and the wallflower is China. And unless we can get China out on the dance floor and engaged in the dance, we're going to have a very unenjoyable evening, and we are not going to be headed for a reasonable solution. So as the report indicates, whatever it takes to get China to dance and talk about this, whether it is the addressing of certain suspicions, be those suspicions real or imagined, I think is a noteworthy challenge. But whatever we have to do to convince China that it has to come to the fore and be willing to discuss these things in a more direct manner with us, I think it's really important. One point in particular, the report notes, and Scott went through this in some detail, that there are four primary interests, and they're somewhat sequential. They're sequenced, and I think they're put in some, perhaps in some priority, although not necessarily, in China's policy approach to North Korea. And those are, obviously, maintaining peace, ensuring stability, averting a hostile presence in North Korea, and fourth, promoting denuclearization. I am sure that those are indeed China's four priorities and accept them as such. And while the report notes that the first two, I believe the language is, are inexorably linked in Chinese thinking, what I would suggest is that whether we like it or not and whether China likes it or not, all four have become or will soon become inexorably linked, and we will not have any more the luxury of dealing with these in sequence or decoupling the denuclearization issue of North Korea from the stability issue, nor from the maintaining peace issue. I think that without getting into it, because there isn't sufficient time here, and it's not the right place, and time certainly does not allow us to discuss China's management or mismanagement of the North Korean nuclear program over the last many years. I would like to say from my perspective, and we've looked pretty hard at this, that at some point China lost the bubble. And in fact, they lost most of the game related to North Korea's nuclear ambitions. And I think it's only reasonable to expect China to take a leading role in addressing this issue openly and directly and in some detail so that we can get the discussion going again. And the reason that I mention the nuclear issue in the context of destabilization and the destabilization of North Korea and the requirement to plan for these things together, I believe we've reached the point, as this situation evolved itself, that North Korea, and this is the immediate concern that I have, with its new role and having assumed and reached the position it wanted to reach for all these many years, now regards itself not only as a self-announced and self-proclaimed nuclear weapon state, but it regards itself as having a different frame of reference within which it can now operate. That different frame of reference puts it on par with certain other powers in the region, other nuclear weapon states, particularly China and the United States, not to mention Russia. But it does something else. It makes other powers in the region, particularly the Republic of Korea, second-tier players. And I think it emboldens North Korea to do things that it wouldn't otherwise do, all to the detriment, I believe, of China. Not China first, but certainly China as a co-equal receptor, if you will, or negative beneficiary of North Korea's new mindset. That mindset has been on display for some time. We need to recall that the North Koreans had no second thoughts about attempting to export a full plutonium fuel cycle to Syria, an incredibly destabilizing event for the Middle East were it not put to waste by military action. I think that we should expect more of this in the near future in terms of regional, international, and other proliferation-related provocations. But that isn't really what gives me, I think, the most amount of concern and brings me back to the subject of this report, and that is, I believe that we have in the North Korean regime now an emboldened organization that is much more capable of doing things that it would not have done 5 or 10 or even 2 years ago, perhaps taking all the wrong signals, making some wrong assumptions, and being capable of being much more provocative in things that it does, particularly vis-a-vis the Republic of Korea. When those things happen, they will not allow, China will not be on board, will not appreciate, will not understand, and will find it very difficult to catch up to the tempo and the direction of such provocative activities by North Korea. in that scenario, in that situation, we will need to have planning already in place among the three parties, the United States, China, and the Republic of Korea, or have some level of understanding along the lines proposed by Bonnie as the ultimate arrangement, whereby we can talk and interact with both the Republic of Korea and, most importantly, China, as events begin to unfold. And is in order that events do not get out of hand, particularly with a provocation or a military incident or even a situation of internal instability in North Korea, I think that if we are positioned as we are today with the relatively low level of coordination that we have among us, we will all be much worse off for it. And I do believe that in that eventuality, the single biggest loser may be China because of its unwillingness and inability to address this issue before a situation of crisis actually occurs. So again, coming back to my original comment, this certainly was a situation that caused us a great deal of concern over many years. I think it's with us today in spades. I believe it will only get worse, and I think the time to begin the process, the Track 2 process that's being here advocated, was yesterday, and I'm very, very pleased that this report exists. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lawless. Let me say a couple of words about this report. I think Bonnie and Scott basically are calling for the United States, and I think the meaning of this paper focuses a lot more on the United States than I think the actual text and what is said in the text, which does focus more on Chinese attitudes and policies and South Korean attitudes and policies. But the real message of this paper may be directed at the United States, and it is, should the United States continue with this near or total emphasis on the nuclear issue in U.S. North Korean policy, or should the U.S. begin to shift its emphasis to other issues related to North Korea, in particular this issue of instability scenarios, trying to develop a dialogue with China on that issue, and underneath that issue, of course, and underneath any such dialogue is the issue of reunification and the character of a reunified Korea in Northeast Asia. And I think you have to ask yourself, should this shift begin to be made by Washington? Or should the nuclear issue remain the centrality of our diplomacy with regard to North Korea? Also, if you conclude that a shift in the direction of what Bonnie and Scott are talking about is justified and that we begin to focus more of our attention on China and changing Chinese attitudes and changing China's resistance to discussing instability scenarios and also a reunified Korea, do we have to think of this exclusively as devising ways, perhaps some policy shifts of our own, that would in the near term trigger a Chinese government change of mind in terms of talking to us about this? Or should we also look at this possibly as a long-term process of gradually changing attitudes, of doing things, making policy adjustments on our side that would serve to weaken the traditional attitudes and concerns that Bonnie laid out with regard to the Chinese attitudes and concerns, to weaken that school of thought and to strengthen the school of thought in China that they talk about with regard to wanting a changed Chinese approach to North Korea. So this paper is important in the sense that it really does look at some fundamental policy changes of emphasis on the part of the United States, and I think is really urging U.S. policymakers to take a very hard look at whether this total 100% concentration on the nuclear issue is really worth it in the future, or whether a more broad-based diplomatic strategy is now necessary, including a shift in our focus into China and into these Chinese attitudes and roadblocks that they have, I think, so succinctly laid out in their paper. Now, we're going to open this up for questions, and I believe we do have microphones that are going to be passed. I see one in the back, so please wait until you receive the microphone, and please identify yourself. Keep your questions or comments reasonably succinct and not go into any really long 5 or 7 minute speeches or statements. That would be very helpful. So where can we begin? Bill Taylor.
Stand up or remain seated.
Whichever you
stand wish. Up.
Bill Taylor from CSIS. Great presentation across the board. Thank you very much. Was there any reference given consideration of regional the role of regional security organizations, which, of course, we don't have? And there have been references to them from time to time. Dick Laney, when he was ambassador, did a mini report about getting Northeast Asia NATO or something like that. Incidents like the ship incident right now, they're the kinds of things that in the future are likely to lead to war. War by accident or miscalculation, the way wars normally start, historically. But any consideration in your report?
Thanks. Who would like to comment first?
Actually, in the report, we did not really take a look at regional security organizations or architectures or even the six-party talks because of our focus on this issue of responding to instability. In some respects, you could say that our contribution to that is really just to highlight a particular non-existent triangle that needs to be formed. I mean, we have several other triangles right now where dialogue is going on various topics in East Asia. And I think that one that is missing that is critical to the future of North Korea is this U.S.-China-South Korea triangle.
Next question. Yes, over on the left here.
Thank you. Paul Eckert of Reuters News Agency. I join those in applauding your timing on this, and probably can guess my angle, but I wonder if there's anything you've observed in the recent weeks dealing with the sinking of the naval ship of South Korea and China's attitude toward that, or this mysterious visit of Kim Jong-il to China that reinforces or otherwise challenges some of the points you've made in terms of China's attitude towards the issue. You'll be aware that there's some disgruntlement in South Korea that China went ahead with this Kim Jong-il visit at this time. There's also signs, at least in the internet chat boards, that Chinese people themselves are less than happy with the hosting of Kim Jong-il, if only for, say, traffic inconveniences and useless pomp and circumstance. Thanks.
Thank you for your question. You know, I think that in the immediate aftermath of the sinking of the Cheonan, it was remarkable that China did not offer condolences for the tragic loss of life. I believe it took over a month before the Chinese finally said something publicly. And I think that that really demonstrates how important at this particular juncture China's relationship with North Korea is. And I think that they are very leery to not do anything that would offend North Korea. This is a time where they are seeking to strengthen their relationship with North Korea in all sorts of ways, political as well as economic. And it is not surprising to me that they went ahead with the visit of Kim Jong-il. This is something that they deem important for their relationship with North Korea. Whether it will produce a new step in the direction of resuming the six-party talks remains to be seen. I think that the Chinese know that there is an expectation by the United States, Russia, Japan, South Korea, all the other members of the six-party talks, that they will use this opportunity to lean on Kim Jong-il to return to the commitments made under the six-party talks and specifically the September 2005 agreement. But my sense is that the Chinese are in a phase of wanting to strengthen their relationship with North Korea, and that reinforces, I would say, the point that we made in our report that the Chinese want to avoid a hostile relationship with their neighbor and want to ensure that they have a good working relationship so that they can position themselves effectively in the event that there is change in North Korea to protect their interests and advance their influence.
I'll add one thing on this, although I think that actually our commentator, Mr. Lawless, very subtly also addressed your question. One of the things that I think one can see from the Chun'an incident was a conscious decision on the part of the South Korean government not to pursue this as an inter-Korean issue for fear that it would further escalate, but rather to internationalize the response. And it seems like China missed that signal. And so as a result, we have the situation that Bonnie just described, late condolences. You have a situation where South Korean president went and met with the Chinese president. The Chinese didn't seem to anticipate that there would be blowback from South Korea in not giving a little bit more information, at least about how they're approaching the North Korea side of this. And now I think the real, you know, interesting test or question is whether or not this effort to internationalize the issue on the part of South Korea is going to end up being supported. And if it's not supported, the South Korean government, in a way, has put itself in a very difficult position in terms of domestic expectations. And so it seems to me that that, in many respects, is where, South Korea is trying something new, and we're going to have to see whether other parties respond to this as an acceptable approach in terms of managing inter-Korean relations through an international framework rather than just through an inter-Korean framework.
Just let me comment briefly, perhaps coming back to something Larry said. The report does ask us to consider a whole range of approaches that the United States might adopt to raising this issue with China and attempting to engage China across the board on all the issues that have been identified here. I guess what I was trying to say, and probably didn't do a good job of it at the end of my presentation, was there is a new dynamic at work, and I am concerned that we have to make the effort, and we do have the time to create these new mechanisms and reduce suspicions on the side of the Chinese and bring the Chinese into a more fulsome dialogue on all these issues. But the dynamic part of this is that the North Koreans may not allow us that time. We have to be prepared for events to evolve dramatically and in ways in which we're not able to predict. The range of activities, provocative activities, that North Korea can take to disturb the dynamic at any moment is almost indescribable, because they are the one non-stakeholder, and happy to be a non-stakeholder, in the entire world process. And they're prepared to go forward on that basis and be very disruptive. So my concern, to your point, is that by putting the Republic of Korea government in a difficult position, by putting China in a difficult position, this has the ability to create a lot of problems and be very disruptive to any process that we're trying to encourage, per the direction of this report, between the Republic of Korea and China, between the United States and China, and among those three parties. I think the North Koreans have many tools to disrupt that process and make it a much more difficult task for us to do.
I don't think we should underestimate, along the lines of what my colleagues have said, do not underestimate Kim Jong-il's ability to influence and manipulate Chinese attitudes and Chinese policies. I think he's been very good at this over the last few years, and I think one of the problems in U.S. policy towards North Korea has been a gross underestimation of Kim Jong-il in terms of his political and diplomatic skills, in terms of devising and orchestrating strategies that, from his point of view, work for him. And he probably is engaged in this as we speak. I guess he has left China now, hasn't he? But in the last few days, I think we've probably seen another example. And over the next few months, in bits and pieces, we will learn more about what he accomplished with the Chinese. And he usually does accomplish some of his goals with the Chinese whenever he goes there. Next question. Joe.
Thank you. Thank you very much for a great report and great discussion. Bonnie, I want to probe you a little bit about Chinese attitudes. You know China better than probably most anybody in the room that hasn't lived there forever. How many times can Kim Jong-il diss the Chinese publicly, directly, before they finally decide maybe they ought to try what Undersecretary Lawless is suggesting? Try maybe working with us a little something. I mean, are there any other examples of countries getting away with this? I mean, they went to war with India, they went to war with Vietnam. I mean, at some point, aren't the Chinese going to have had it with Kim Jong-il and with the North Koreans?
Well, I think that there's no doubt that there are many examples of North Korea's behavior, including its nuclear tests and missile firings, and if it turns out that they are responsible for the sinking of the South Korean ship, we will just add that to the list. The Chinese undoubtedly find these acts to be destabilizing and might even say deplorable. They don't think that that is the kind of behavior that will help to produce the regional security environment that China wants, so that there will not be an arms race in the region and there will be generally good relations among states so that China can continue its rise in the region and globally. But I think that, you know, I would certainly say there has been a very intense debate in China, especially in the aftermath of the second nuclear test, about whether or not to modify their policy towards North Korea. And the willingness of China to get on board with international sanctions, to me, does not signal a dramatic departure from their pre-existing and long-standing policy. The Chinese would like to have good relations with North Korea, but would also like to cooperate with the other countries to promote denuclearization and other objectives on the Korean Peninsula. I mean, I think China, more than any other country, really does want North Korea to pursue economic reform and be on a sustainable basis so that they don't have to shoulder the burden of propping up this regime, which they continue to bear, although they are willing to do so because the alternatives are seen as profoundly against Chinese interests. And I think that the question that you're really asking is there sort of a red line that if North Korea crosses, that then China will say, we've had enough, and we're going to stand up with these other countries and ensure that North Korea changes its attitudes. I would say the answer to that is probably no. The Chinese are not going to sacrifice their good relationship with North Korea because they believe that that relationship remains exceptionally important and that it is through that relationship that they can best protect Chinese interests. And so my sense is that there's nothing that I can think of, although you might come up with some major game changer if there were a terrorist action somewhere in the world and it involved use of a nuclear weapon, and through forensics we were able to trace that back to North Korea, I would call that a game changer. Let's hope that doesn't happen. But within the realm of the kinds of things that I think we would expect to see, I don't think that China's policy towards North Korea is going to change dramatically in the future. That's not to say that they don't see North Korea as, in some ways, a strategic liability. But in far more important ways, it remains a strategic asset.
Also an insulting regime, directly insulting.
Let me make a quick comment. Being a party of the six-party talks, what I was always struck by was the degree to which the North Korean behavior, literally on an hour-by-hour, day-to-day basis, could hold the Chinese hostage simply by its unpredictability, by its aggressiveness, and by China attempting to manage the misbehaving student in the room. And it was never, they were never able to do so. The North Koreans absolutely delight in tormenting China. I believe it. And I believe they take a visceral delight in that, probably for some historical reasons. And I don't think this is necessarily a relationship of love or even mutual respect. It's a relationship of mutual disrespect. But that being said, as Bonnie mentioned, there is no tipping point yet. The question is, if China's main priority is stability, and if this nuclear capability causes the North Koreans to behave more recklessly than they have behaved in the past, do we then reach a tipping point within the leadership of China? And I think that's the debate that may be occasioned at some point. But again, we've got 2012 coming up, perfect storm, so who knows what happens between now and 2012, right?
Bonnie and Scott point out China's concern, and you might even describe it as fear, that if they start to talk to us about instability scenarios, North Korea will be alienated and may penalize China in some way. This is fear, and it's the same kind of fear that the North Koreans try to instill in us all the time. So they work the Chinese side, as I think Bonnie and Dick Lawless have pointed out here, in some ways in the same way that they work us. And they do achieve, admittedly, some real successes with the Chinese as well as with us. Next question. Yes.
Thank you for the presentation. My name is Kyunmi Kim. Well, I'm a correspondent for the Korean newspaper. My question will be very specific, to the recent incident and what's happening in Seoul and also in the Korean Peninsula. First of all, about the Cheonan incident and also after the investigation is closed, Scott has mentioned that Korea has tried to take this internal incident to the international arena. How do you think China would go along with the other international players on taking some part of an action? The second one will be to Ms. Rawlis. Do you think that this China incident and the situation in Korea could be a factor to delay? I mean, there are requests from the Korea that this should be reconsidered as a factor to delay the transfer of the OPCON in 2012. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that one of the critical issues that we just don't know yet with regard to the outcome of the investigation is whether or not it's going to produce a real smoking gun. And I think that the quality of the evidence is going to have a direct impact on the degree of difficulty that nations like China would face if this is taken to the UN Security Council. And so unless and until there is a direct smoking gun, I think in a way it's going to be a lot easier for China to deflect any real significant pressure in terms of having to make tough decisions on this.
Yes, I agree. I'm sorry. Yes, just very briefly, I think the Chinese, no matter what, will be missing in action on the Chonan incident for a whole variety of reasons. But on the OPCON issue, that's a very tough question for you to ask me because I have very strong feelings about wartime OPCON. And I would certainly hope that given the increased capabilities of the Republic of Korea, that the Chonan incident is not misused or misapplied in any way to try to create a political decision that reverses a policy decision that was made several years ago. And I think, again, we realize it's the political season in Korea and we have elections coming up there, and therefore things tend to trend toward political decisions, but it would be very unfortunate if that's what drove this.
Next question. Dennis.
Yes, I had a question. When
please identify yourself.
Oh, I'm from the Foreign Affairs Committee. I work for Ms. Ross Layton. In Bonnie talking about a red line and talking about the Chonan, I mean, if something determines, certainly the Chinese should recognize in international law, remember the Maine, the Lusitania, sinking another nation's ship is an act of war, if that's what it turns out to be. Now, the North Koreans probably don't care. I mean, they've blown up the South Korean cabinet. They've tried to assassinate South Korean presidents. They've axe-murdered American soldiers, grabbed the Pueblo. So that's probably not an issue. But my question, if North Korea keeps provoking, as Mr. Lawless suggested, that they keep on this, and they provoke their way into another war with South Korea, and China sees this. I mean, in 1950, Kim Il-sung provoked his way into war, and he was supposed to be in Busan in 2 weeks. It was supposed to be over. And then MacArthur landed in Incheon, and suddenly the Chinese found themselves in a war with the United States. So is there no red line? If North Korea were to provoke its way into another war with South Korea, what would China do? Would that be a red line? Or they certainly have a lot more to lose by having a period of isolation with the world and the United States as they did in 1950. They've got a lot more to lose now. So could they be dragged into another Korean War by North Korea?
I think that the Chinese would like to avoid getting embroiled in another conflict on the Korean Peninsula at all costs. If it were really clear that North Korea was the provocateur, my sense is that the Chinese have already told the North Koreans that the clause in their mutual security treaty would not be operable. There have been some reports that the Chinese have even asked North Korea to excise that clause from their mutual security treaty, but that the North Koreans have not agreed. I don't know whether that is, in fact, accurate. But certainly, every Chinese that I have talked to about this question emphasizes that China, the last thing that China wants to see is any kind of war on the peninsula. And as we list the interests that China has, peace is really at the top. And when the Chinese, I think, go back and assess the Korean War, one of the lessons that they take from that war is that they really damaged their own interests in that war and caused the Seventh Fleet to interpose itself and begin the process of U.S. protection of Taiwan that lasts in some ways until this day. This is not a mistake that I think the Chinese want to make again, and they certainly don't want to see themselves in a war with South Korea and with the United States. And there's no scenario in which this would be in China's interests.
I think that the advantage that North Korea is pressing right now is actually South Korea's fear of escalation. And the real issue, actually, that we and the South Koreans have to be concerned about if the North Koreans do have this new psychology and are going to engage in this type of asymmetric selected provocation is, you know, how do we reinforce deterrence? What is the strategy by which to respond effectively in order to, you know, send North Korea a message that they can't pursue this kind of provocation with impunity? And that's a serious matter that we really have to focus on.
My former colleague, Mark Mannion, in the back.
Hi, Mark Mannion from CRS. Larry, it's very strange to see you on the other side of that table. When we were colleagues, we'd often sort of do a tag team routine. So I'm going to play the same role here and sort of take your comment and put it to Bonnie and Scott a little bit and push them a little. In the sense that, you know, I'm not sure I get a sense for what your strategy is or how you envision a strategy for changing China's approach to thinking about and cooperating trilaterally with the future of the peninsula. I mean, you know, Bonnie, you mentioned that these, assuaging the mutual suspicions may not be sufficient. So what would it take? Would it take some steps in addition to some of the steps that you do recommend that the U.S. take, for example, being more transparent? Would it take some other steps that are perhaps more proactive on the U.S. and South Korean side, basically going to the Chinese and saying, in effect, if you aren't more cooperative, here are the things we're going to do, such as discussing more robust missile defense, other actions that might, in effect, put the pressure on China to the fact that putting pressure on them that if they don't cooperate, here are some more aggressive stances that we're going to take. So bottom line is, what is your strategy for getting the Chinese to be to change their attitude and their thinking about this?
Well, I think as Rich said earlier, this is a very difficult goal to achieve, and it's hard to say how much time we have. If the situation really were to begin to unravel in North Korea, if there were really clearer signs of instability, I believe that then the Chinese might see it as more in their interests to have this conversation than they do today, when I think that they believe that instability is not likely in the future. So as I said, I think their assessment of the situation in North Korea is one of these variables. It is difficult for us to change that assessment. It is going to be North Korea's behavior that is most likely to shape that assessment. But I think another piece that I have not raised today that should be part of U.S. strategy is to essentially make quite clear to China that the U.S. and South Korea are going ahead and preparing for responses to instability in any case without China. And it is not in China's interest to not participate in that conversation, because we are going to be prepared to take actions that will have an impact on China's interests, and the way that China acts will have an impact on our interests. And I think that what we can do is to highlight more clearly the downsides and the dangers of not coordinating, and make it quite clear that we are moving ahead without them. Now, you mentioned missile defense. I mean, cooperation in missile defense is going on, should go on regardless. It's not aimed at China. And China's cooperation might not limit the need for missile defense. There's, in my mind, no connection there. But China can understand what the role of missile defense is, for example, in U.S. and South Korean strategy in the region, and that can be part of assuaging their concerns that it isn't part of what China often posits as a region-wide, you know, network of what they used to call theater, you know, missile defense that's hooked up with Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. But I do think that if we begin the process of assuaging suspicions, and that can be done, you know, unilaterally, bilaterally, as well as trilaterally, that we can create this environment in which China might become more open-minded. And ultimately, what they need to do, as I said, is to change the risk-benefit calculus. If they continue to see that the risks of engaging the dialogue exceed the benefits, then they're not going to do it. So the onus, therefore, I believe, falls on us, unfortunately, and on South Korea to try and change that risk-benefit calculus.
Yes, in the back.
Tuck, I'm a student at George Washington University. Do you think that the Chinese government has become more risk-averse with the upcoming leadership transition from Hu Jintao and Wang Jiabao to Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang? And then also, Mr. Lawless mentioned that we need to somehow engage China and draw them into participation more, you know, that we should sort of get them back to the point where they were willing in 2003 to quietly shut down oil pipelines. What methods would be best suited for getting back to that stage? Do you think that it would be prudent to offer economic incentives to the Chinese, or what other methods do you think would be most effective?
Let me do the easy one first, the latter part of your question. Something that occurred to me as the discussion was taking place up here, I believe one of the reasons that beyond alienating North Korea and probably provoking very serious reaction from them if China did talk with us and it was known that the conversation was taking place, beyond that, I think one of the things the Chinese are challenged by is when you start talking about something like this, it's a very complicated issue. People talk about, well, we'll just secure some nuclear weapons or we'll secure some weapons of mass destruction. North Korea has got like 12,000 rabbit holes that it's jammed stuff down into. So I'm serious, if you begin this discussion, the discussion would get into a very complicated, involved, detailed discussion. And once you opened that discussion, I think the Chinese would be, frankly, great participants in that discussion because we have no choice but to try to figure all these things out. So maybe one of the reasons people don't want to talk about it is if you say, let's talk about it, it leads to incredible levels of complexity and you realize the task is truly gargantuan, even in a perfect instability situation where you could go in and remove the WMD, it may be a very challenging activity. So to answer your question, the best thing we can do, per the report, is if the Chinese are willing to talk to us, is to offer a fair level of transparency, as much transparency as we can possibly offer, and say, this is where we think the bad stuff is. This is how we think we got to get at it. Unfortunately, most of it is probably up close to you, China. It ain't necessarily close to the 38th parallel. So wherever it is, let's talk about it, and let's get into the guts of this discussion as we have to do. So probably what we have to offer is transparency, and we should not assume the Chinese know very much at all. They have been routinely excluded from North Korea, and the degree of that alienation is probably not well respected by our side or not appreciated. But there's a lot to be done here if we ever agree to do it. That's my point.
Let's see, we had another question over here. Yes.
It was the first part.
Sorry.
Let me just answer quickly the first part of that question. You know, I think that Chinese leaders are almost always risk averse. Perhaps you could say that around times of succession, they become even more inwardly focused. But I am not myself a proponent of the recent narrative about China that we have seen in the media so prominently recently, that China is becoming more assertive or more aggressive. I would say that Chinese assertiveness, to the degree that we have seen it, has primarily been in defense of what the Chinese define as its core interests, which generally is defined as Taiwan, Xinjiang, and Tibet, though occasionally also includes China's exclusive economic zone. But in the case of the Korean Peninsula, I think that the Chinese have been and will continue to be risk averse.
Question over here.
Nicholas Hamasevich from the Heritage Foundation. Did the report touch on or any thoughts on the concerns of historical claims, the Goguryeo issue, where historical claims have China's borders extending into North Korea and Korea into China? Are these historical issues important for a dialogue of this kind on instability in North Korea, and kind of how should the U.S. deal with these historical issues and claims? Thanks.
This is an issue that we discussed as part of Chinese concerns regarding or suspicions regarding South Korea. In particular, we've heard on a number of occasions over the course of the past 2 years the Goguryeo mentioned, and also Goguryeo issue mentioned, and also moves by South Korean nationalists similar to have essentially a much broader claim territorially, basically using Goguryeo as a kind of precedent. Now, I don't know whether the Chinese should be really taking that so seriously. But it definitely is an issue that has come up. And frankly, there are potentially challenging issues that might emerge between a unified Korea and China that if this conversation that we're advocating proceeded well, you know, might be able to address, although it's kind of a distant prospect.
Yoshi.
Yoshi Komori of the Sankei Shimbun. The author of this report sort of kindly included Japan in this very ambitious proposed undertaking by simply stating that the Japanese top leaders should be informed of the result of this ongoing process. But can you tell us anything beyond Japan's, about the Japan's role, simply being informed? And secondly, my question to Mr. Lawrence, we have been seeing a lot of a drift, if not a disruption, in the U.S.-Japanese security relationship. And if the trend continues, how would it impact or affect this proposed undertaking by the three other countries? No. Thank you.
On the Japan question, I mean, U.S., Japan, and South Korea contingency planning is another issue that we could write another report about. And in fact, some people have written reports about this. And I think that it's clear that through the alliance framework and through Japan's role in support of any potential contingency on the peninsula, there's actually a need for a more active trilateral discussion. We know that there's been progress in terms of improving the U.S. ROK plans, and presumably that discussion has also been broadened to include Japan, but I don't know if it has really been done as effectively up to now as it might be. And then, of course, the other obstacle is related to the current Japanese political environment. So.
Let me comment about this. It seems to me that if there is a breakthrough in this Chinese wall of opposition to discussing this. I think the initial stage, which could last for quite some time, is not going to be some sort of visible or even semi-invisible tripartite dialogue. I think if the Chinese decide they want to talk about it, they may well decide we're going to talk about it only to the U.S. and we're going to keep this very secret with the U.S. That means we don't want to bring the South Koreans in right away, at least. So in terms of a broadening of this dialogue to possibly even go beyond South Korea, I think you have really likely a staged process that would take place that could go on really for quite some time. It could be an extended staged process that would expand only slowly after certain periods of time and after certain perceptible progress was made. So that could be the process, starting with China and the U.S., and then perhaps with progress being made, bringing in South Korea and perhaps the other countries as well. Next question. Oh, yes, go ahead.
I thought I'd escaped. Gosh. I would just say that since we have enough challenges just managing the agreements and the relationships we have right now in our alliance with Japan, and it's frankly a very frustrating, demoralizing process because we're simply trying to get that alliance to a place that functions reasonably well and operationalize that relationship, which it isn't. I think that probably Japan couldn't reasonably expect to be a primary player, although it should. But I think to have standing to claim that position, you have to man up, so to speak, and show up at the game. And right now, we're not at that place, I don't believe. That's my personal opinion.
I'd like to ask Bonnie and Scott a question. To what degree does China's role in the nuclear talks, China's role as the chairman, China's role in having, frankly, an agenda that it urged on the United States since the beginning of six-party talks back in 2003, an agenda that in 2007 and 2008 the Bush administration basically bought into in terms of how it tried to negotiate with North Korea. But to what degree does China's role and its view of these nuclear negotiations influence its attitude about this other kind of dialogue with us that you believe should be moved toward in the future?
Well, I think that there's some influence, although I'm not sure I would exaggerate it. Certainly, the Chinese would say that anything that China, any dialogue China has with the United States or any other country that would be seen as potentially detrimental to North Korea might undermine the prospects for the six-party talks. Indeed, we can cite the example of the agreement by China to hold talks with the United States and Japan. And then the Obama administration felt maybe the time wasn't right, and then the Chinese pretty quickly also concluded maybe the time wasn't right. And I think that China was concerned potentially about North Korea's reaction. We, of course, continue to listen to our South Korean allies who, in the end, I think were willing to go along with it, but were never really happy about the idea of U.S., China, and Japan sitting down and having a conversation, even if we promised that we would not talk about North Korea, there's always that potential that that it would come up. But I think that the Chinese don't want to engage in any process that they think would undermine the six-party process and the prospects towards denuclearization. But having said that, if they said that publicly or even privately as the reason why they didn't want to do it, I would say that that was rather insufficient, because I think that the real reasons go far deeper as we've explained them.
I'm going to do the flip side of that. I think for China, one of the reasons why they're so attracted to the six-party talks is because as long as that framework is there, they can claim that diplomacy is not exhausted. And so to the extent that we have this, you know, break in the six-party talks, it actually provides an opening and a basis upon which to make a case for engagement on other issues like North Korean instability.
Yes, in the back.
Hi, Brian Andrews with the Department of State. I have a question that's a little out of scope for the report, but I think it's a topic that's very much in the report, and that's the question of North Korean behavior. And as Mr. Lawless was saying, it's a country incapable of self-restraint. I was wondering if you all had any thoughts of, is there a viable U.S. policy approach to influencing North Korean behavior at this point? I mean, is any policy recommendations or thoughts of what the U.S. could be doing or U.S. and ROC could be doing? Possibly U.S. and China, but that's more difficult, of course.
Who would like to take that?
I'll take the first shot. I believe, maybe not everyone does, but I believe that the only thing the North Koreans respect is certainty and to some degree force. And I think China understands that that's how we have to deal with North Korean provocations. So this entire issue of how do we manage or prepare for a North Korea that may be more assertive or may be potentially more provocative in the future is simply, I think, by tightening our belts, making sure that we're linked up really tight with the Republic of Korea, explaining in some detail our dilemma to China, because certainly the Chinese realize that we have a problem. And the problem is, how do we manage on a day-to-day basis, real-time, provocations that the North Koreans can pull on us? And literally, as I mentioned earlier, there are thousands of scenarios that the North Koreans, as bad actors, can do to disrupt the Republic of Korea itself, provocations, military provocations, provocations against civilians, and whatever it is. And I think what we have to do is, I would like to see a much more detailed discussion with China that explains our situation going forward and tries to get the Chinese to understand that we have, in many cases, we are not going to have the luxury of talking about something for 3 or 4 days after it starts to happen. We will have to respond real time. And the Chinese have to be sympathetic to that. So I really think the sooner we begin talking to China about quid pro quos and actions and reactions and how things get out of hand, the better. And that goes to the heart, I think, of this report, because even if you have, and I'm going to use the term, the mechanism, terms of reference, because I think that's what Bonnie and Scott are talking about. If we had terms of reference for a dialogue with China about instability in North Korea, within those terms of reference, we could go back and talk to them about issues just like this much more openly. And right now, the channels to do that in practice don't exist. So I just think that we need to, as the situation becomes more tense, potentially much more tense on the peninsula, we really need to tighten ourselves up with China and explain these things to them.
It seems to me, and I would second what Mr. Lawless just said, it seems to me we need to tighten up our discussions with China on the nuclear issue, in particular to get the Chinese to talk specifically about what they believe can be accomplished in a next stage of six-party talks or nuclear negotiations. Now, the Chinese urged us for a long time to concentrate on the plutonium program, to concentrate on Yongbyon, to defer, put on the shelf, uranium enrichment and plutonium. And again, as I just pointed out, the Bush administration basically adopted that agenda in 2007, in 2008, and however messy it appeared at the time, Yongbyon is shut down right now, is disabled. So that is an accomplishment. And I suppose the Chinese can take some credit for that accomplishment. But it seems to me, in terms of influencing North Korea now, we really need to sit down with the Chinese on the nuclear issue and say, okay, what next? What are the next specific goals that you believe can be accomplished in the next stage of talks? I don't think the Chinese have really said what they think can be accomplished. I think we need to get much more specific about them in terms of the nuclear agenda and to see what areas of cooperation there could be between the U.S. and China in getting the North Koreans to move further in any next round of nuclear talks.
Do you guys have comments on that?
I think we have time for one more question.
I think we've exhausted the questions.
Is everyone exhausted? Well, I want to thank all of you for coming today, and I want to thank Bonnie and Scott for an excellent paper. Read it. And U.S. and ROK policymakers need to read this paper for sure. I want to thank Dick Lawless for his excellent commentary, which really contributed to our session today. And again, thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you, Larry.